It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. U.S. Steel announced yesterday they plan to pump $1 billion into the construction of an endless casting and rolling facility at the Edgar Thompson plant in Braddock and a new cogeneration power facility in Clairton. The plan has three parts: streamlining the steelmaking process, adding a new power plant in Clairton, and advancing manufacturing training for existing employees. I'm joined from across the river by Pittsburgh Post-Gazette business reporter Daniel Moore. Daniel, I understand you're also listening into U.S. Steel's earnings call right now. Thanks for squeezing us in.
I had to step away. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Daniel, let's start with that first prong, steelmaking. Do we know yet how much of a difference this will make for the company, investors, the workers?
Yeah, so the bulk of this investment is essentially bringing in technology that's never been installed at a U.S. steel mill before. And what it basically does is combine casting and rolling of steel. So very basically, these are usually two distinct and separate facilities at a steel mill. You have liquid molten steel that's at like 300 degrees Fahrenheit. It's funneled into a caster, which molds the steel into any shape that you want. And then normally it's cooled to room temperature and put to the side, and then it's reheated and put into a rolling mill, which is where it's rolled and then sent down the line to an automaker, appliance manufacturer, the construction industry, whoever's buying that steel. Mm-hmm. And so what U.S. Steel is doing is combining those two processes, the casting and the rolling, so that you don't have to cool that steel down to room temperature, reheat it to roll it. It's all one facility. And of course, that leads to dramatic gains in efficiency. One expert said the technology can cut the plant's energy use in half. And just having a smaller footprint, you know, making one facility from two facilities is going to lead to some pretty dramatic cost savings. You mentioned jobs. I mean, one of the big questions I see is how this affects jobs. The announcement does not lead to any new jobs being created. And in fact, normally when you have efficiency gains at any kind of factory, it leads to less man hours needed to operate
right. That
the same process. So that's a big concern.
All right. So U.S. Steel said it'd be the first of its kind and put Western Pennsylvania back on the forefront of advanced manufacturing. From your reporting, do you get a reinforcement of that comment?
You know, I think that's the perception right now. I mean, that's been the reaction, certainly at the announcement yesterday at Edgar Thompson. You know, a few hundred people were gathered, workers were giving standing ovations. And it is very interesting because the company's argument here is that we need to make the Mon Valley Works competitive again, because for many years, this type of plant, which dates back to 1875, has been facing stiffer competition, not just from foreign steel imports from China, but from other plants that have come online and can in the United States that can produce steel in the United States more efficiently. So, you know, the company's argument is that we need to, you know, now's the time to pour money into the plant. And the reaction has been this, you know, it seems like universal, this is great. This will help keep jobs in the Mon Valley, even if there may be fewer jobs.
Right.
Because of this technology coming in.
You mentioned China, and earlier you said first of its kind in the U.S., but is somebody else already doing this process, such as a China? Do we know?
Actually, yeah. So this type of technology isn't very many places in the world. It was invented by an Italian company. So it's at one plant in Italy, and then it's at four plants in China. So you're seeing this technology around the world, but it's the first in the U.S.
I spoke with County Executive Rich Fitzgerald in his office yesterday, just after he returned from that public announcement at U.S. Steel that you attended. He says he had an idea that this was coming.
Oh, I think we got a little heads up on this in the last week or so. And they obviously wanted to keep it quiet as they talked to a lot of their stakeholders. And it the investment that they're making, $1 billion, is certainly significant. What it does, it will preserve the jobs in the Mon Valley. And I believe there's about 3,000 steelworkers who work at those facilities in the Mon Valley for decades to come. You don't make that kind of an investment and then, you know, decide to shut down or whatever. So this is good news for stability in the region. It also improves the environment, and it proves that you can do both.
U.S. Steel says this will be the first of its kind and put Western Pennsylvania back on the forefront of advanced manufacturing. How important is that reputation to you and to Pittsburgh's identity?
Well, I think one of the things we learned, you know, years ago, and a hard lesson that we learned, was when all you do is one thing or just a small number of things, you're always vulnerable to changes in technology, changes in the global marketplace. And we got hurt. We got hurt very badly. What you see in the Pittsburgh economy right now is diversity. So it really puts us in a stronger place, because if any sector of the economy has a downturn and a slump for, you know, a year or two, or sometimes longer than that, the rest of our economy can stay strong. And I think advanced manufacturing is still important, not just to this region, which is a backbone of what we've done over the years, but to this country. And steelmaking is always going to be very, very important. And the fact that, you know, Pittsburgh has always been ahead of the curve when it comes to technology. We're proud of the fact that U.S. Steel, with some of the research and some of the things that they're doing, are going to be advanced ahead of everybody else, which obviously makes them more competitive. But it's also improving the environment and improving the stability for the workers in that region, knowing that they're going to have a future for years to come.
Clairton Coke Works is the biggest known polluter in our area. Do you believe this will change that? And the plan that was announced mentions climate change by name. Are you convinced this is something U.S. Steel is concerned about?
Well, yeah, I think they are. I think a lot of the things that have happened over the last couple of years that the health department and Dr. Hacker and her team have brought to bear, some of the partnerships with even the EPA and the DEP, bringing some of the actions that they have taken. But yes, I think the partnership that's getting, I think, better, not just with Allegheny County and the state, but I think U.S. Steel has also reached out to some of the communities out there where their plants are located, Clairton, Braddock, Dravosburg, Liberty, Lincoln, West Mifflin, McKeesport, et cetera, Duquesne. So these communities all have a great history, but they all have, you know, I think there just needs to be good, strong partnerships between the company and the communities.
Briefly, will this mean more jobs, same number of jobs, or maybe even fewer jobs because the whole process is more efficient?
I think what we're seeing from what they're saying is probably about the same amount of jobs. At least it stabilizes the jobs. I guess moving forward, I guess we'll find out.
Rich, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thanks, Kevin. Good to be with you.
That was County Executive Rich Fitzgerald. Remaining on the line with us is Post-Gazette business reporter Daniel Moore. Daniel, a lot of talk about this will be better for the environment. Do we know yet if that's really going to be the case?
I think there's a hope that it will be. I mean, the company has said on the record that it expects, largely because the plant is using less energy and operating more efficiently, that the projects are going to reduce emissions of particulate matter by 60%, sulfur dioxide by 50%, and nitrogen oxides by about 80%. So there's emissions reductions expected as a result of this. I think where a lot of the anger is and a lot of the disagreement is among environmental advocates is that there's not a lot of investment here at the Clairton Coke Works, and that there isn't a lot of projects planned to help, you know, the batteries operate more efficiently there, which is where a lot of the emissions is coming from, the gas leaking from the coke batteries at Clairton. So just by virtue of being more efficient, I think there will be emissions reductions, it seems like, but it remains to be seen, you know, how much.
Okay.
In the future.
Less than a minute left. Our reporting partners at State Impact Pennsylvania found very little in the way of feedback, reaction from environmentalists yesterday. Some said they were surprised. Others remarked on the timing. U.S. Steel has been sued 3 times and a 4th time just yesterday. And of course, the fire at the Clairton Coke Works Christmas Eve. And yesterday they released their earnings report ahead of this morning's call. Does this timing mean anything to you?
You know, this is something that U.S. Steel says it's been planning for many years. You can't just, you know, get $1 billion to spend in reaction to something happening, you know, 4 or 5 months ago. So I believe that they've been planning this for a while, but it's also, for them, seemingly good timing, just because they can come out and say, you know, look at these emissions reductions we're going to have.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
at the same time, they're appealing the health department fine. So it's a mixed message.
Daniel Moore is a business reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Daniel, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. It's marathon weekend in Pittsburgh, and while thousands of runners will take to the streets, even more will take to the sidewalks to cheer them on. That includes a very special team of Greyhound dogs. Then, four new measles cases were reported in Allegheny County. The new cases are all within one family, and health officials say it's due to international travel. So what does that mean for the rest of us? Get conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence at wesa.fm/confluence.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. The only two fraternities at Swarthmore College near Philadelphia disbanded this week amid outrage over years-old documents, including jokes about sexual assault and derogatory comments about women, minorities, and the LGBT community. The fraternities closed following days of protests. Also, parking tickets are down in Pittsburgh as more drivers pay via the city's parking app. That means less money for the city. At the same time, tax revenue from people who work in Pittsburgh is up, suggesting an influx of jobs. Find these stories and more at WESA.FM.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. For years, residents in Pennsylvania living near fracking sites, pipelines, and other oil and gas infrastructure have complained about impacts, including pollution. Now, prosecutors have launched criminal probes into the state's fracking boom. For State Impact Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier explores where these investigations might go.
When he ran for attorney general in 2016, Josh Shapiro promised to prosecute the state's fracking industry. In this campaign ad, he said regulators were being too soft on polluters.
All they've ever gotten is just a slap on the wrist. It's time for that to change. I'm Josh Shapiro, and I'll hold the oil and gas companies criminally liable for poisoning our air and our drinking water. I'll be an attorney general who always works for you.
Democrat Josh Shapiro appears to be living up to this promise. He's summoned witnesses before an investigative grand jury in Pittsburgh to look into possible environmental crimes related to oil and gas activities. Close to Philadelphia, he's helping Delaware County prosecutors investigate the troubled Mariner East pipeline, which has caused sinkholes, contaminated well water, and leaked gasoline into waterways. Meanwhile, Chester County District Attorney Tom Hogan has launched a grand jury investigation of his own on the Mariner East. Here he is in January talking about his decision to investigate the pipeline.
Somebody's got to step in. Our citizens are very concerned. And as soon as our prosecutors and investigators started digging into this, they said, yes, there are significant problems. Yes, some of them could fall into criminal charges.
A spokeswoman for Energy Transfer, the company behind the Mariner East, declined to be interviewed. But in a statement, she said there was no, quote, legitimate basis for an investigation and that the company would aggressively defend itself. Penalties for environmental crimes can include fines, probation, even jail time. Typically, these prosecutions involve proving the intent or mental state of an individual or corporation, says David Ullman, a former environmental crimes prosecutor for the U.S. Department of Justice. Ullman, who's now a law professor at Michigan, says companies can't plead ignorance of the laws they're accused of breaking.
You know, ignorance of the law generally is not a defense in the United States. And it's not the case that companies can say, oh, well, I had no idea that that the law applied to my conduct, or I didn't realize what the law required.
Prosecutors have a high bar, proving a case beyond a reasonable doubt. But they also have tools that other government agents don't. These include the ability to convene a grand jury, says Mark Fried, a former prosecutor in the Pennsylvania Attorney General's office.
They have the power to subpoena, so they are very useful in conducting investigations, gathering the evidence that's needed then for the prosecuting agency to then decide they have enough information to make a charge.
Having subpoena power means prosecutors can talk to people who've signed non-disclosure agreements with oil and gas companies. Shapiro and his deputies have used this to talk with Stephanie Halowich, a Western Pennsylvania woman who testified before the grand jury in Pittsburgh in February. In a lawsuit she settled in 2012, Halowich claimed Range Resources and two other oil and gas companies contaminated the air and water at her Washington County home. A letter from Shapiro to attorneys in another civil case involving Range asked they preserve documents and evidence. So is Range a target of the investigation? That's tough to say, says Jamie Colburn, a former EPA attorney who's now a Penn State law professor.
You don't open a grand jury investigation because you know who's guilty. You open a grand jury investigation to find out if anybody is guilty.
Spokesman for Range Resources didn't respond to multiple requests for comment. The Attorney General's office won't even confirm there is an investigation, let alone discuss details of the case. Before it was settled, Hallowich's lawsuit also named the state's Department of Environmental Protection as a defendant. In other high-profile contamination cases, public agencies tasked with safeguarding water supplies have become targets for prosecution. In Michigan, the state attorney general has charged 15 officials for their roles in the Flint water crisis, and three have pled guilty. Shapiro himself charged Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority with more than 150 counts related to lead in Pittsburgh's drinking water. So far, there's been no indication that Shapiro is investigating DEP's role in regulating oil and gas companies. Chris Carasone, a former chief deputy attorney general in Pennsylvania, says he wouldn't bet on that happening.
Yeah, I think that would be highly unlikely. I can't imagine a scenario where the attorney general's office could investigate the DEP for failing to do its job.
He says typically environmental crimes are reserved for individuals or companies, not government agencies.
You could have a scenario where a state employee is charged with conspiring with a business entity or other individuals outside of the agency to violate the law.
Allman, the former Department of Justice lawyer, says prosecutors can only enforce laws already on the books. He said criminal investigations are no substitute for regulation of industry by legislatures and state agencies.
You can't go in through the back door and sort of regulate through litigation conduct that you haven't regulated at the front end. Or at least you can't do that in the criminal law.
One possibility most agree on, prosecutors could go through all this and decide they don't have enough evidence to bring charges. Grand juries in Pennsylvania can last up to 24 months. When they're done, they can release their findings in a report. Reed Frazier, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. An estimated 40,000 people are participating in various events for this weekend's running of the Pittsburgh Marathon. Sunday, when the full 26.2-mile contest gets underway, community groups and spectators will line the route, including the Steel City Greyhounds. Yes, greyhound dogs. They're a nonprofit dedicated to rescuing and finding new homes for retiring racing pups. Joining me in studio is David Anderson. He's treasurer with Steel City Greyhounds. Welcome, David. Good to have you here.
Good morning, Kevin. How are you?
And you brought somebody with you. Who's with you?
I brought Anna, my greyhound from Spain.
And how old is Anna?
Anna's 4 years old.
All right. You'll have to check it out on the website. We will have photos of Anna on the website. Trust us. Anna actually has a job. It's almost full-time, I guess.
Anna goes to Children's Hospital 4 days a week. She's a therapy dog there.
Oh, that's wonderful. Your organization has grown in popularity and is now rumored to be one of the most enthusiastic cheer groups along the course. So how long has Steel City Greyhounds been doing this?
We've been doing this 7 years, mm-hmm. and each 7 years we've been voted the number one cheerathon on our part of the marathon.
So it's no longer a rumor.
It's no longer a rumor.
Okay. And you are at the intersection of Fifth Avenue and Frankstown Avenue?
Yes, we're at mile 18 in Homewood.
So tell us a little bit more about the organization itself.
So we're a 501c3. We're set up to rescue retired racing greyhounds and ancillary. We're set up to rescue Spanish greyhounds as well. We've adopted out about 800 of them over the last several years. This is our biggest fundraiser. The marathon is our largest fundraiser. We have 27 runners this year, and we'll have between 25 and 30 greyhounds and 50 to 60 volunteers manning our cheerathon station.
I have to ask you, for those interested in adopting, because you mentioned finding homes for these pups,
Do you need a big yard? I mean, these are retired athletes, after all. You need a big yard. Do you need to be like a 2 mile a day walker or more?
Well, the Greyhounds are known as the 40 mile an hour couch potato. When on the track, when they're racing, they race twice a week for 30 seconds. So when my dogs go for exercise, they go in the backyard, do 3 or 4 laps, and then back to the couch. To answer your question, you do not need to have a large yard. They're great apartment dogs, great city dogs.
Sounds like a good retired life.
They take retirement seriously.
Your organization's volunteers will be out and cheering, as we alluded to. Will there be any four-legged fans with you and barking their support? How do they show their support?
Greyhounds aren't big barkers, but what we do is we line that block of Frankstown Avenue, and occasionally we will hand a Greyhound to one of the runners, because they're mile 18, as you know, it's getting pretty tough at that point. Mm-hmm. And they'll run a block with the Greyhound, and it's a big deal. I mean, that really kind of revives people to watch these guys, you know, running with the Greyhound.
Now, is it fair to say that members of your organization and in their own way, the pups, will be cheering for all participants?
Oh, we cheer for everyone.
However, your special cheer for those 27 runners?
Our 27 runners who've raised a large amount of money for us, of course, we'll have a special sign for each of those people who are running past us. Mm-hmm. And we'll try to recognize them and maybe run with them and cheer them on a little bit extra.
People are hearing about this. They hear that, maybe they were not scared off, but they need to be an athlete themselves to adopt a Greyhound. How can they get in touch with you?
Well, the Greyhounds, they can be an athlete. They can go on the 2 or 3 mile run with you, but they can be the couch potato as well. So we adopt Greyhounds to young people, young couples, older people. They're actually a really versatile breed as far as adoptions go. Mm-hmm. We can be contacted at steelcitygreyhounds.org, and on our website there is a application. And then after you apply, we'll call you and have an interview, and then we'll show you the Greyhounds.
And I assume, because Anna, the beautiful pup you have sort of laying at your feet right now in the studio, is, as you mentioned, a therapy dog, goes to Children's Hospital several times a week. I assume they're great family dogs as well.
They're great family dogs.
What are the characteristics of the Greyhound?
Well, they're really laid back. They're very affectionate. They're not their average intelligence. And like I say, they make really, really mellow, calm family dogs.
I have to tell our listeners, when you said average intelligence, Anna stuck her head up.
Well, Anna's not average, of course.
All right. David Anderson is with Steel City Greyhounds, one of the favorite cheer groups for participants in the Pittsburgh Marathon. David, thanks so much for coming in, and thanks for bringing Anna in.
Thank you, Kevin.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pennsylvania's craft brewing industry is growing fast, adding almost 100 breweries in just the last year. But people who want to break into brewing don't always know where to turn for help. WITF's Rachel McDevitt reports on an effort from Shippensburg University to build the craft beer workforce and promote the industry.
We're going to have fun. We're going to make beer today. We're going to drink beer.
Brad Moyer looks like someone who would teach a craft beer class. He has the bushy beard, the flannel shirt, the laid-back attitude. He's inside a bright dining hall on an otherwise quiet Saturday morning on Shippensburg's campus to teach about 20 people the secrets of home brewing. It's the first class of its kind offered by the university, and just the start of a series of courses for both hobbyists and brewing professionals.
Yeah, let's get rolling, like I said.
Moyer started out home brewing over a decade ago, and now has plans to open his own brewery in Cumberland County this summer. He's just one example of the rapid growth the craft brewing industry is seeing in the Commonwealth. In 2011, its economic impact on the state was just over $1 billion. In 2017, that figure grew to more than $6 billion. Pennsylvania now produces the most barrels of craft beer in the country, more than 3 million per year.
Has anybody in here actually ever homebrewed before? Okay, good.
This class is for novices. Shippensburg is offering it because of interest in another program it's developing, which is geared toward people already in the industry.
Yeah, I mean, anybody can make great beer once. by accident, you know, to repeatedly make good beer is really where you need that education.
Allison Feeney is a driving force behind these programs and is on hand to help teach the class. She's a professor in the Earth Science Department and wrote a book on Pennsylvania's craft brewing industry.
You can get me 3 gallons of water and they're ready to rock.
As the students crowd around a large pot in the dining hall's kitchen to start the brewing process, Feeney explains she was drawn to the industry after she noticed how many small breweries play a role in revitalizing communities.
I really love how these breweries are renovating old spaces, and they're really contributing to sort of keeping small downtowns throughout the state.
But in doing her research, she also noticed how there was a lack of training opportunities for beginner or even more seasoned brewers.
It was one of the things that a lot of the brewers would say to me is there's really no great place to learn their skill. It's through trial and error, and you know, as the industry matures, there's a need for some higher skill sets.
The university was recently awarded a grant by the Pennsylvania Liquor Control Board to put toward courses that help build the brewing workforce.
Really good. So that's what we're going to use today, fresh hops.
Carolyn Callahan, the Dean for Professional and Continuing Education, says they've been collecting input from area brewers on what kind of training they want.
You know, we're finding things like they need help in terms of branding and social media. How do you set yourself apart when you're talking about an industry growing this quickly? There's those growing pains, too. How do I take my business to the next level?
Callahan says as a school in the state system of higher education, Shippensburg can act as a bridge to the community, an access point for anyone seeking higher skills. The professional development courses are slated to start this summer.
The options are literally limitless.
Longer term, Professor Feeney is talking with her colleagues about how they could design a comprehensive brewing degree program that would combine the science and business of beer.
We already produce the most amount of beer. We want to make sure we also produce the best beer. And I really honestly think Pennsylvania is pretty close to that.
Let's divvy up some beers here, figure out what we got.
As the participants bottle up samples of a chocolatey milk stout to take home, Moyer says he feels like he's going back in time to his own homebrewing days.
To see the interest in their eyes and see the possibilities, I could see the gears turning already, and I remember that initial spark, and I could see it coming. So it was really humbling to see that, and I hope we inspired somebody today. You know what I mean?
He says he'd be happy to have any of the day's students come and work for him, or who knows, maybe he'll end up working for one of them. Rachel McDevitt, Shippensburg, Cumberland County.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Allegheny County Health Department confirmed Thursday 4 new cases of measles. This is in addition to one other separate case reported earlier this week. We're going to talk about measles coming to the Pittsburgh area, best advice for parents of small children, and for adults who were vaccinated or not decades ago. Dr. Mark Roberts is the chair of Health Policy and Management at the University of Pittsburgh's Graduate School of Public Health. Welcome to The Confluence.
Thank you.
Also in studio is WESA's health and science reporter, Sarah Bowden. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Kevin.
Sarah, let's begin with you for some of the latest news items. You covered the press briefing held by Health Department Director Karen Hacker. 4 new cases. Are they connected?
The 4 cases are connected to each other, but not the case that was announced earlier this week.
All right. And the 4, they're family members?
They are family members. An adult and 2 kids were traveling, visiting the other adult from overseas. And I believe it was one of the kids was infected with measles at the time. Mm-hmm. And that kid spread it to the other child in the family and the 2 adults.
All right. So what's the status of the 4 right now?
One is recovered. One is in the hospital but doing well, and the other 2 are at home quarantined.
Okay. So I want to bring this up. Karen Hacker said these cases are related to international travel, as Sarah just told us. Is that more concerning, less concerning? Dr. Roberts?
Well, it's both. Actually, I think the concern is that most cases of measles and most of the sporadic outbreaks that we've seen in the United States recently, many of them have started in other countries and people travel to the United States. They wouldn't produce sporadic outbreaks if we had high vaccination rates and if those people didn't come to communities that had people who were not vaccinated. Mm-hmm. So that's the real danger. Many of the cases come from out of the country, but they can spread if we aren't vaccinated.
And to point out, Kevin, the case from, I believe it was Monday or Tuesday of this week, that gentleman came from a different country than the three individuals who are related to the most recent cases. So different countries, not related at all, even though both international travel.
And both wound up in Pittsburgh.
Both wound up in Pittsburgh.
Okay. Ever since the news started to break about measles hotspots, including Brooklyn, we started hearing about herd immunity. What is that exactly, Doctor?
Herd immunity is a concept by which the number of people that an infected person can, when they contact them, the likelihood that the person they contact is already immune. If herd immunity, if there are enough people in a community that are already immune to the disease, the probability is that when I touch somebody, they're already immune and I don't pass it on. Mm-hmm. And that herd immunity typically is in the high to mid-90s somewhere.
What about Pennsylvania? Is that...
In Pennsylvania, we are doing pretty well. We have relatively high vaccination rates overall, but there are pockets of very low vaccination rates.
Within the Commonwealth.
Within the Commonwealth. And that creates problems because a specific introduction into reasonably at-risk communities has much more likelihood of producing many more cases than if it was just the average. And you can't really talk about the average because there are specific schools that are that have low and specific communities have very low vaccination rates.
And for the county, our entire vaccination rate for kindergartners entering into school is 97.6% for the 2017-2018 school year, which is pretty good. I can't speak to specific communities within Allegheny County, but the entire county has a pretty good vaccination rate.
So doing pretty well in trying to convince people that it's the smart thing to do.
I think so.
All right. I want to ask you how this might, we focus a lot on children, as we should, but how might this affect older adults, maybe born before 1957, because school age is around 1963, right. And that's when the measles vaccine was first developed?
Yes. I mean, people born before that time are assumed to be immune because it was such a pervasive disease, and virtually everybody got it. If you got measles and recovered, you are immune for life. And so that's not a problem. It's easy to check whether or not you have immunity to measles. There are lab tests that can check whether or not you have immunity to measles or not. But the general assumption, and it's a pretty good assumption, if you were born before that time, you were exposed to measles and are immune.
What about dead vaccine? We're hearing that term as well.
So the original vaccine, there are two ways of making vaccines. Well, more, but the two main ones are what's called a killed vaccine, which you use the actual virus, but the virus itself is killed. And then there are live attenuated vaccines, where the vaccine is an actual virus that has been damaged so that it can't hurt you as much. And the killed vaccines were not quite as effective as the live attenuated vaccines. And the current two-step vaccine is far more effective than the original one. It still provided 93-ish% protection, 90-something, I forget exactly.
What would you recommend for people worried that they might not be immune? Is there a problem with adults getting vaccinated?
There's not really a problem with adults getting vaccinated. It's a safe vaccine. But I would talk to your doctor and talk to the public health department.
I believe you can do a blood test, right?
You can. You can do a blood test to see whether or not you have immunity to many of those viruses.
Speaking of getting vaccinated, there have been a lot of questions about when to have the little ones vaccinated. Sarah, I know you've been looking at this in your reporting. What have you been hearing from health professionals about when's the best time for the little ones?
Yeah, so I talked with several pediatricians this week, and they say to stick with the CDC recommendation of no earlier than 12 months. So the first shot you should get between 12 and 15 months, the second between 4 and 6 months. If you are traveling to an area where there have been outbreaks, you can get the vaccine earlier, as young as 6 months.
Yeah. Doctor, there are some children who can't be vaccinated. Briefly, why so?
Well, that's the real crux of this problem. There are a certain number of children who can't be vaccinated because of diseases or conditions they have. Kids who are immune compromised, either from HIV disease or other immune diseases, children who are on chemotherapy for cancers, children who have certain immune disorders and certain rheumatologic diseases. Some of the medications they take make them less able to take vaccines. So there's a wide range of kids. In some communities, 2 or 3% of children who cannot be vaccinated. They cannot accept the vaccine. And then there's also, in a group of people who are vaccinated, there's a few percent. Most people estimate it's about 3% of children. The vaccine won't work. It won't confer immunity. So in any community, there's on the order of 5% of children who, through no fault of their own, are susceptible to getting infected. And that's really the crux for us as public health professionals, that says it's not just the impact on your own child if you choose not to vaccinate your child. As you lower the herd immunity of the community, you endanger other kids.
So is that the message that you would put to people who are cautious or just refuse to have their children vaccinated?
I think that's one of the messages that they would, that it's important to know that it's other children are put at risk here. I would also say that you have to remember this is a relative risk problem. And if you believe there are risks to vaccinations, and there are some risks to vaccinations, but there are significant risks to not being vaccinated, and you have to make that balance. For us as public health professionals, we have to protect everybody, however, and the children who can't protect themselves have no choice in the matter. They are susceptible, and we need to protect them.
We have just 2 minutes left. Briefly, Sarah, I wanted to ask you, anything else you took away from Dr. Hacker's news briefing yesterday? She used the term about, I believe, alarm in that and outbreak. Is there real concern within the health department?
I mean, they're being very cautious right now. They want people who were at the airport to be on the 16th to be watching for a rash anywhere between the 23rd of April and May 7th. But I think that it's very measured. I didn't get a sense of abject fear yesterday.
All right. So Pitt's Public Health Dynamics Lab has created a simulator that anyone can use to see how measles would spread in their city depending on vaccination rate. Doctor, briefly, what's the purpose? Are you trying to reassure people or potentially alarm them, scare them? Look how fast it could spread? What?
All we're trying to do is provide the data on what happens when you lose herd immunity in a community. And we created this simulator for any county in the United States, and it shows you what happens at if only 80% of the children who should be vaccinated are vaccinated, and compares that to what happens if 95% of the children who should be vaccinated are. And you get as many as thousands of cases in some places, if only. Now, 85% is a very low number. There aren't many communities that have that. There are schools that are well below that. There aren't whole communities that, but it's a simulator that shows you the impact of losing herd immunity. And it's freely open to anybody. You can just Google Fred Webb and you'll find it.
All right. And we'll put the link on our website. In our last 20 seconds, I want to ask you, you mentioned there are schools, communities. So really the demographics and the density of those communities impact the herd immunity, do they not?
Yes, they do. There's a theoretical herd immunity for a uniform population that we can calculate mathematically. But for any given specific community, the actual levels you need to prevent transmission vary by how many people you contact, about the density of the schools, the density of the communities, and that sort of thing. So, and the simulation takes that all into account.
Dr. Mark Roberts is the chair of health policy and management at Pitt's Graduate School of Public Health. Sarah Bowden is WESA's health and science reporter. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, drop-in centers allow people with mental health diagnoses to help each other. But there aren't that many in Pennsylvania, leading to long wait lines. If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Julia Zenkovich and Meg Fair. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good weekend of good news.